Okay, thank you. A couple of places in the Anguttara Nikaya where the Buddha compares mindfulness of mind states to holding up a mirror. I like that, you know, that sort of momentary sense of holding up a mirror. What is the mind state? I was also just thinking of just how helpful that invitation from Ajahn Sumedho is to say, oh, so sadness is like this, or anxiety is like this, blankness is like this. And on the this, there's that sense of really tuning into the felt sense of the mind state. You know, the felt sense in the body, the felt sense of the world of that mind state, contracted, expanded. And also just that sense of, as John was saying, the not taking personally. It's not, I'm feeling angry, but anger is like this. And that's a portal into compassion, isn't it? Because we recognize that although the story of anger may be different for different people, that the experience of it is so similar. Find it a very helpful little phrase to drop into, you know, teaching the breathing space or the extended breathing space. Those of you who teach MBCT will know that as you go through the course, working with session 4 called recognizing aversion, which is nice, isn't it? Because that's the knowing the mind, recognizing aversion, and then using the breathing space as a way of tuning into the mind state, and just to have that sense of it's like this. And one can hear that sort of practice lying behind. We realised we hadn't actually read to you the Buddha's instructions on mindfulness of mind in the Satipatthana Sutta. So I'm just going to do that, reading a translation that John has done of this sutta. So this is the section on mindfulness of mind. And how does a bhikkhu, a practitioner, us, we're practicing. How does a bhikkhu dwell watching mind as mind? Here, a practitioner knows a mind affected by desire as a mind affected by desire. He knows a mind unaffected by desire as a mind unaffected by desire. She knows a mind affected by hate as a mind affected by hate. She knows a mind unaffected by hate as a mind unaffected by hate. He knows a mind affected by delusion as a mind affected by delusion. She knows a mind unaffected by delusion as a mind unaffected by delusion. She knows a dull mind as a dull mind. He knows a distracted mind as a distracted mind. She knows a higher mind as a higher mind. He knows a lower mind as a lower mind. She knows an inferior mind as an inferior mind. He knows a superior mind as a superior mind. I just want to say, we'll explain what that means, because it doesn't, you know, it's not judgmentalism, just worth pointing out. He knows a concentrated mind as a concentrated mind. She knows an unconcentrated mind as an unconcentrated mind. She knows a mind that is freed as a mind that is freed. He knows a mind that is not freed as a mind that is not freed. And then the refrain, which is, as John says, this refrain occurs 13 times during the sutta, occurs after each section. And so the version of it after the mind section is, in this way she dwells watching mind within as mind, or he dwells watching mind without as mind, or she dwells watching mind within and without as mind. She dwells watching the way things arise in the case of mind, or he dwells watching the way things pass in the case of mind. Furthermore, his present moment awareness that there is mind is established so that there is knowledge and recollection in full degree. He dwells independently, not holding on to anything in the world. This is how a practitioner dwells, watching mind as mind.
Okay. I just wanted to pick up one particular part of this formulation because it's such an important part. It's such an important part, I think, both within the practice of MBCT and also in the practice of Buddhism in general, which is when the Buddha says he dwells watching the way things arise in the case of mind, or he dwells watching the way things pass in the case of mind. Very simple, but something we tend to forget quite simply, is whatever that state of mind that we are introspecting, that we're coming into contact with by taking up this particular position as the watcher of, is impermanent. Now let that sink in for a second. It's impermanent. Part of our taking it personally is in some ways to impede that impermanence. We create stasis where there, in fact, there is movement. Because in attaching the sense of I, you know, the first person pronoun, when we attach it to I, with a state of mind which is depressed, I've made it static. I've somehow impeded that arising and passing away that is so intrinsic to the nature of the mind from the Buddha's point of view and the Buddha's perspective. I think this is something we clearly see, even if we are fairly unfamiliar with meditative processes, with, you know, sitting and looking at the mind. As the moment you sit down, you're aware that stuff is rising and passing away, and rising and passing away. And you know that because we have this phenomena which, again, is referred to, it's a Buddhist term, but it's actually come into MBCT, that we have this phenomena of monkey mind. You know, the mind is going from one thing to another, one thing to another. What happens to the previous thing that was so important? When it moves on to something else, it's passed away. So this is absolutely intrinsic from the Buddhist perspective, from this perspective of Buddhist psychology, to the nature of the mind. The mind itself is not a thing. It's not a thing. It's an impermanent phenomena. Consciousness itself, one of the possible translations of this term, citta, consciousness itself is an impermanent phenomena. So much so that, you know, in some forms of Buddhist psychology, they delineate hundreds of different forms of consciousness arising with different mental factors. Simply arising and passing away, breaking up for something else. It's not mentioned in the early texts, but this gives rise to the idea in later commentarial traditions that actually the nature of the mind is what's called momentary. It's like sort of firing momentarily, all of these things. However, as soon as we turn it not from seeing mind as mind, but turning it into seeing it as my mind, we somehow start to inhibit that sense of process. So it's a really, I mean, I don't know if you can see how important this is, because often what happens is that the I narrativizes. There's a story around the sense of the I, and that I in relation to whatever the mental state is or the mood, using those words interchangeably here, also becomes narrativized. Yeah. In creating narrative, we create stasis. Yeah. This is the way it has been, and this is the way it will be. History into further movement into the future. It's a way of temporalizing something which is extremely fleeting, that's engaged in, that we're that's occurring, which we call mind. Now, that word itself, again, I'd kind of throw this open to you. You know, when you think about that word mind, mindfulness of mind, well, what are we doing in mindfulness of mind? It comes back to a really practical question again, doesn't it? What are we doing when we're being asked to do this? You know, is it, here's an image of the mind that often comes up for many people. In fact, I think it's even used in MBCT sometimes. You know, the stage with all the things trooping across it. You know, those are all the mind states trooping across the stage. In a way, even that is not the way the Buddha is speaking about the nature of mind. There is no stage, there is no container, there is only the process. There is only, if you like, the actors. You know, and those are consciousness moments. And consciousness itself, I mean, I'll give you a lovely little phrase that comes out of a slightly later tradition than the very early text, where it says that consciousness is like a king. It never arises alone. It always comes with a huge retinue. Yeah. It always comes with a big retinue, just like a king or a politician these days will come with all their hangers-on and all the people to do what they do for them. Consciousness is like that. It's coming with a retinue. And those retinue, that retinue, and actually it's cognate in the original language with that term, is called chittasikas. Mental states, or mental factors. So every consciousness moment includes mental factors which will arise and pass away, and arise and pass away. So what we're getting an image of in terms of the impermanence of mind is a constant series of arisings and passing away of consciousness plus mental factors coming together. You know, when they stay around even momentarily, we call that a state of mind. You know? But that state of mind, as you will know, probably from getting up this morning to coming here to how you feel at this present moment, if you've introspected in any, took a little snapshot in that journey that you've had this morning from getting out of bed, you have had many different moods, all of which have arisen and passed away and arisen and passed away. So the Buddha's understanding of the mind, and I think it's really important in what we're doing and the kind of work we're doing in MBSR and MBCT, in taking that, you know, step back, that distanciated approach, is being able to see this as process, as movement, rather than stasis. So it's absolutely at the heart of the Buddha's understanding of the mind. And therein is the key to liberation, again. In being able to liberate oneself from holding on to mind states. In other words, creating the narrative around the I and whatever that mental state is. Chris.
Okay.
Did you notice in the sutta that there was the equal encouragement to notice the presence and the absence of mind states? And I think, you know, building on what John's been saying about impermanence, it's, we know that, in a sense, again, we're hardwired to get sort of busy and agitated and to notice unpleasant mind states when they're present. But we often don't notice when they're not present. We don't sort of enjoy the absence of irritation or the absence of desire or the absence of confusion. And I love that the Buddha's saying, you know, really value that. You know, like take that arms question, you know, what's not wrong? Like, can I enjoy that? You know. And it does seem as though, you know, these minds from an evolutionary psychology perspective, you know, they evolved for survival rather than for happiness. And so we have to take deliberate steps to orient towards that sense of well-being, or towards those moments where there is just a quiet sense of contentment or peace or non-activation that's there.
I think it's very important as mindfulness teachers and practitioners really to affirm those moments when actually the mind isn't agitated particularly. You've probably heard of the reading from suttas is always slightly, one can sense people's eyes slightly glaze over the repetition. We're just not used to it, are we? You know, think,
but watch the mind state.
Yeah, exactly. But just to sort of unpack a bit of that, the Buddha says, okay, he works through the three, what are sometimes called the three poisons of as John translates, in desire, hatred, and delusion. We could think of that as wanting, not wanting, and confusion or bewilderment. But, yeah? These are, and the Buddha sees these as the sort of root distortions, if you like, that are underlying difficulty. The basic sense of, you know, pulling something towards you, pushing it away, and getting sort of confused. And there's one place where the Buddha compares, I've got the reference down, that desire is like fire. It's got heat to it. The hatred or the aversion, because hatred's quite a dramatic word, isn't it? But it's just the subtle sense of I don't want this. But the Buddha describes it as being a bit like a grip, a tightening. We can feel our system tightens when we don't want something. And delusion is being like a net. Because we get sort of caught and entangled in confusion and bewilderment. You know? And so he's saying, notice the presence of those and the absence of those. Notice, in the sutta, notice distraction, notice dullness, sleepiness, and the absence of sleepiness. Notice restlessness and the absence of restlessness. And I think that's there's a very practical aspect to that, just acknowledging these states and their absence. And as the refrain was saying, just to build on what John was saying, what is it that gives rise to, you know, that the meditator dwells on the way things arise and the way they pass. What is it that feeds a certain mind state and what is it that fasts it? It can be a very helpful question to ask when we're caught in the grip of a difficult mind state. What are the factors that give it fuel, give fuel to the fire or tighten the grip or deepen the entanglement? And what are those factors that don't add fuel? Because in a very real way, this practice is about just choosing what you feed, isn't it? Selective watering in the garden of the heart, as one teacher puts it. And I like that sense of that this is about minding at some level, that mind is not an entity but a process here. And we have these moments of holding up the mirror and knowing the state, but minding is a process. And perhaps it's worth saying that we're particularly today talking about the early Buddhist view of citta, because you will encounter in, say, the Zen tradition or some other Buddhist traditions, even the Thai forest tradition, they can present citta as being a sort of entity, as a sort of pure mind view. Pure awareness view, and you find that in sort of Advaita teachings as well. And I think it's just helpful to know that there are these different ways of relating to this word. There can be times in one's practice where it is helpful just to have a sense of sort of awareness as if it's a sort of something that I can rest back into. From the early Buddhist point of view, as John said, it's an experience of knowing that arises out of the contact between sense organ and sense object. Yeah? So consciousness is this momentary consciousness that comes and goes in six domains, the five senses, the five regular senses, seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, and the sixth sense, which in Buddhist psychology is the mind. So, if you like, the mind thoughts are to the mind what sights are to the eyes. And that there's a moment of consciousness of knowing that. So consciousness, in a certain way, is sort of flickering from this point of view, because it's lots of very, very quick moments of knowing. Does that make sense? Rather than it being this entity called the mind. It's a arising and passing of experience. And, you know, if we think about the, what is it at the start, know the mind, shape the mind, free the mind, it is worth recognizing that you know, mindfulness involves more than just knowing the mind, according to this sutta. You know, sometimes we can have a view that mindfulness is simply just to know what's happening. Well, in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha, there's a much greater sort of repertoire of practices and approaches that the Buddha is offering, all of them under the heading of mindfulness. Does that make sense? So, you know, noticing impermanence is an aspect of mindfulness, you know. And the Buddha encourages the deliberate noticing of impermanence. Not just, you know, I happen to notice it, but almost to use that as a lens through which to view experience. And I think, you know, as mindfulness teachers, it can be very helpful, or as mindfulness practitioners, you know, to put that, to encourage the use of the lens of impermanence, say when doing a body scan. You know, because it's very easy to operate with the view that there are these solid things called toes and feet and calves and knees and legs and all that. And actually, these are processes. These are changing, flickering, dynamic, you know, in sort of unstable processes, if you like. They're changing moment by moment. And to practice viewing them through that lens rather than reifying them as solid objects. The Buddha is saying, incline the mind towards the seeing of impermanence, and that is deeply liberating. Does that make sense? You know, impermanence is one of these three you could say that there are three characteristics. Impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. And these are the portal characteristics. It's the seeing of these that liberates the mind. One can also present them as ways of looking at experience. Contemplation. So the contemplation of impermanence, seeing things as impermanence, really noticing the impermanence of mind state, so that even if I'm clinically depressed, there are moments in the day when the mind is not clinically depressed. The label gives an illusion of permanence, doesn't it? Like the label feet gives an illusion of permanence, or body gives an illusion of permanence. It's to start to see the momentary nature of experience, that it's coming and going. How, you know, that is liberating, isn't it? It's freeing. Frees things up. Things become less solid. They become more fluid. They become more dynamic. They become more amenable of being shaped, to use that term. So there's the lens of impermanence. There is the lens of unsatisfactoriness, which is partly to see that things can't satisfy, that mind states can't satisfy. It's so easy to be chasing pleasure in our lives, isn't it? Chasing pleasure and avoiding pain is the sort of, you know, the biological default that we seem to have. And yet the Buddha is saying, you know, that's not the way to freedom. That's not the way to happiness. And so part of what we see in noticing the impermanence of mind states is that they don't last. They do come and go. They are like the weather, ever changing. And that the refuge is in the knowing rather than in the mind state. The refuge is in the knowing of that rather than the mind state itself. And then this sense of not self, this third way of looking, this third characteristic, where we practice, as we've been saying already, you know, seeing mind states as not me, not mine, just mindsets. Seeing thought patterns as not me, not mine, just thoughts. Thought buses, as we say in the Mindfulness in Schools project, because they come along and want to take us for a ride, don't they, thoughts. And actually, part of the freedom is to see, okay, this is just a thought pattern. And they've treated it as fact or treated it as self, but actually, I'm practicing seeing it as just thought, just phenomena. You know? So we can see that part of the shaping is really to inflect the way of looking in line with these truths or these skillful noticings of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. This is the shaping and the freeing, ultimately, is through seeing these more and more clearly. You know, I try to remember as a mindfulness teacher and as a relatively human being that you never meet the same person twice. You know, just reflections like that. Because it's easy, isn't it, as a teacher, to have a sense of, well, who are the difficult ones in the class, you know? Who are the ones who are... And it's so easy just to settle into views of permanence at very subtle levels, you know? We do it with family members and friends and everybody, don't we? That tendency to permanentize people, experiences, myself. And just to have a sense, I never meet the same person twice. You know, no two breaths are identical because no two moments are identical. And just to keep inclining the mind, this is really very key to the liberating shaping of mind.
And just again to follow on from what Chris is saying, I think what he's saying is really important because part of what's going on is a sensitization towards our mental processes. A sensitization but not a rarefication of. And what's so interesting about this passage, and I just, again, it's something here that Chris didn't mention, but, you know, for example, let's just read you the first part again here. A practitioner knows a mind affected by desire as a mind affected by a desire. He knows a mind unaffected by desire as a mind unaffected by a desire. A mind affected by hate as a mind affected by hate. Unaffected by hate as a mind unaffected by hate. A mind affected by delusion as a mind affected by delusion. A mind unaffected by delusion as a mind unaffected by delusion. Prima facie, you could read that or hear it and just think, well, that's just simply the absence of the state of mind that's mentioned, you know, desire, and then its absence. Interestingly, again, it's a linguistic point, but within these languages, when we talk about from actually desire, which is the word lova, or greed, which is another translation for it. So in this text, you will see these two words occurring, which would be lova, alova. Alova just doesn't mean the absence of something. It means the presence of something else. Yeah? And what is being implied there is to know mind which has lova, to has desire, or actually, in particularly in this case, it's raga, which is more like passion, or lust, or its absence. What would the absence of that often look like? Well, it might be, actually, if we take this particular version, desire or greed, it might be the presence of something more generous. Or, let's take another example, when there is the absence of depression, what state of mind is there, even if it's very briefly? There is something present. You know, the kind of maxim that nature abhors a vacuum, mental states are exactly the same. There's going to be something else present when that other quality of mind is absent. Very specifically in the text, these are often referred to as three fires. Later on in the Buddhist tradition, they get referred to as three poisons of lobha, dosa, moha. Lobha, greed, desire, aversion, hatred, and delusion or confusion. With the absence of those, there is often going to be their opposites present at that moment. And why is this important, you might say? Well, first of all, it's getting to know the nature of the mind. That's the sensitization part of it. Beginning to see what is actually going on. To, in a sense, see that any mental state, even if it's a clinical state, isn't monolithic. It has other moments within it. Yeah. Probably some of you have seen videos of Fritz Perls working. Yeah, you know, when Fritz Perls was working, sometimes you'd catch people out. You say you're depressed, you just laughed. Yeah, what's going on? And I think part of that is actually just to make people aware that there are other states which are present when that is momentarily absent. Yeah? That's part of sensitization. But there's another dimension to this which is actually paramount in the Buddhist side of things, not necessarily in MBCT, but in the Buddhist side of things, is because the ethical question is absolutely paramount. Yeah? Every question in Buddhism and the way that we function and understanding that functioning and, you know, introspecting the ways that we function is actually to do with how better can we operate and flourish in this world, you know, with other people, which is the big difficulty, isn't it? Yeah. It's all very well when you're an isolated hermit, you can probably function quite well, put you amongst other people. But that's when things usually go awry. So the ethical question, and ethics actually, if you think about it, doesn't make any sense if there are not others, really, for us to interrelate with, then the ethical question is absolutely paramount. So understanding this, understanding states of mind and the moodedness, is so, for example, in those momentary glimpses of the something else that might be present when there isn't greed there, can be expanded, can be actually literally the meaning of the word, of actually the Pali Sanskrit word bhavana. They can be cultivated, they can be grown, not meditated on, but grown. Yeah, it's a very agricultural metaphor, like planting a seed, cultivating it and growing it. So in the absence of greed, desire, where there might be generosity, the question becomes then, having seen this, is it possible to cultivate that as more of a presence in your life? So it's not simply about absences. We're not just noticing vacuums and blanks in our experience. What we're often noticing is the very opposite quality to the one such as greed, aversion or delusion here. Actually, the word moha is a very interesting word. And this is why I'm possibly translating mainly as confusion rather than even delusion, which is what I use in here. It actually comes from a root in Pali and Sanskrit, which means to be stupefied. It's literally like somebody's hit you over the head. And you're walking around the world slightly dazed, not knowing your way around. However, fortunately, life isn't always like that, is it? Yeah. There are moments of clarity, there are moments of understanding. Yeah. It's looking out for those. So when we're beginning to introspect the mindfulness of mind, we're doing it in this way non-judgmentally, we're understanding this is the process of mind as it occurs, remember, because it's impermanent, in this moment. So in practicing this, coming back to that notion of impermanence again, we're only seeing a snapshot of the mind at this moment. Yeah? And at this moment. And at this moment. Yeah? Even if it's a 45-minute meditation session, you're seeing at this moment, at this moment, at this moment. And you will see it change. Now, there's something that is absolutely primal in this process, which is the ability to move from what I call an unreflective stance to a reflective stance. Now, what I mean by that is simply the feeling that we all know is when you're in a particular mental state of being caught up with that. It could be anxiety. I'm caught up in anxious feelings, in anxious mental states. However, there's something very different, isn't there, about that feeling of moving into an awareness of an anxious mental state. Yeah. And one of the defining categories of that is that awareness of that mental state is not anxious. It's not the quality of the mental state itself. Yeah. So it's kind of a second order experience, a reflective experience on a pre-reflective experience in which we are usually just caught up in. Yeah. So there's a huge movement, well, it doesn't sound very much in language, but there's a huge movement from being anxious to being aware of anxiety. Yeah. And that is what's being encouraged in this mindfulness in mind.
Yeah, I remember hearing that from a Dharma teacher that on one occasion, you know, the mind that knows depression is not depressed. The awareness that knows depression is not depressed. Very helpful. Just even in this moment, you could notice that that which knows the experience of this moment is not caught up in it.